From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina does relatively well when it comes to parental school choice. That's according to an expert from the Libertarian Cato Institute. You'll hear his assessment. North Carolina's senior U.S. senator recently praised a UNC law professor. That's because the professor could soon fill the state's long-standing vacancy among federal district court judges. You'll hear highlights from the remarks. After years of inactivity, the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law is back in action. You'll learn about its plans. And we'll discuss how Trump administration policies could offer more options for North Carolinians who are seeking health insurance. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The North Carolina Department of Transportation is having money problems. A new report on dwindling DOT cash reserves comes after earlier this year, DOT announcing they had plans to lay off hundreds of contract and temporary workers. Transportation Secretary Jim Trogdon points to several different reasons for all of this, but state legislative leaders have questions. And so do we here at the John Locke Foundation. Joe Coletti is following the story for the Locke Foundation. He analyzes transportation and budget issues as a senior fellow. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Should we be concerned about all of this?
Money problems any place in state government are a concern and should be a concern. And the Department of Transportation, the lack of a cash balance there and the dwindling cash balance, some of that is legislatively guided, but the McKinsey report that you alluded to in the introductory comments, taking a look at what's going on in the department, did point to some challenges with primary engineering and with what they called the culture of cash. And both of those are basically that there's not enough oversight of what's happening within the department to be able to make sure that the cash is being brought down in a responsible manner. So they recognize that they have to bring the money down and probably made some mistakes along the way in how quickly they did that and how they were managing projects along the way.
We're about, 4 months or so into the fiscal year. So they've got to operate for another 8 months or so and already having cash issues. Give us a sense of the amount of money we're talking about here for DOT.
Well, the department's budget is $5 billion, which is a large, which is about $3 billion, $4 billion from the state. And $1 billion from the federal government. And along the way, they also bring in, they also have bonds and some other borrowing that they do to make sure that they can maintain the cash levels. And that is divided between the Highway Trust Fund, which is mainly for construction, and the Highway Fund, which is mainly for operations and maintenance. And then it gets weird because the federal money goes into the Highway Fund, even though that's for construction of new roads. And so that's where some of the confusion when taking a look at things starts to come in as well, because in one of the bond issuances, the department said that they were loaning $1 billion from the Highway Trust Fund to the Highway Fund. But that was part of this cash drawdown so that they could reach so that they could bring in the federal funds. The federal funds are only provided to the state after the state spends money. And because the federal funds go through the Highway Fund, if we're going to do construction on federally related roads, then the money can't be in the Highway Trust Fund, which is only state roads. It has to be in the Highway Fund. So you loan $1 billion from the Highway Trust Fund to the Highway Fund, spend that money, and then the federal government eventually sends that $1 billion back. So all of this is really confusing, kind of like who's on first, but it's what's going on. It's the nature of how the department is funded. And there are a lot of other confusing things with how the budget works there, but that part is kind of almost straightforward, but
is the legislature going to somehow give them money to make sure that they operate? And we should say that Secretary Jim Trogdon has pointed to several different things. He's pointed to bad weather, having to put out more money than they anticipated, apparently to repair roads and things associated with hurricanes and major storms. Also, there's been some talk about maybe estimates on some projects weren't up to par, that the costs came in higher than they thought. And then they have to, DOT, have to pay out to people who are considered, quote, victims of the state's MAP Act, which has been declared unconstitutional. Those folks are going to get compensation. I bring all that up, Joe, just to say this. Shouldn't have leadership at DOT been able to at least anticipate some of this?
They did anticipate some of that. That's part of the cash drawdown that they were doing. The challenge, I think, comes in with the estimates of projects that the secretary mentioned, and with the just general cash management that they had there. And so how much of the lack of reserves is unanticipated seems to be about half of that, about $400 million potentially, based on the McKinsey numbers. And so that's the concern. The MAP Act is a long-term challenge for the department, because estimates have been between $300 million and $1 billion of liability that the state has to owners who have had their property, who have been compensated less than what they should have been, to make way for roads and other projects in the Department of Transportation. And then the hurricane relief and the storms and the extra response that's had to be with salt in the winter and just the rebuilding of things after hurricanes and slides, that's part of that. It's higher than it's normally been, but it should be within the range of what is possible. So the ability for the department to continue it shouldn't be an issue, because that's the cash balance, and money is still coming in through the normal revenue streams of the gas tax and sales taxes on cars and the other pieces that go into what the department normally has. So they are still receiving money. It's just that the cash balance is coming dangerously close to what the minimum that they have to have.
Well, speaking of receiving money and the gas tax, et cetera, not only do state lawmakers and leadership at DOT have to deal with the current issue and what's happening, but going forward, there are some big time questions, Joe, that you've been analyzing and writing about at johnlock.org about what we do when we're in a situation where we're not going to have enough money coming in to build and repair. So give us a sense of what we face here in North Carolina.
Well, we have both at the state level and at the national level, there is a greater demand for road construction and road maintenance and operations than there is money available. Part of that may be that we've overbuilt. And part of that is that as cars have become more efficient, and as we move to more electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, the gas tax becomes a challenge for most places. The federal highway tax and the federal gas tax funds the federal highway trust fund. And then the state relies for the greatest portion of its transportation money on the gas tax as well. And so if we're moving more to electric vehicles, then that becomes a less reliable source of funding.
Are we looking at potentially needing to propose and get buy-in on more toll roads, or maybe technology that vehicle miles traveled, something like that?
Those are both options that both at the federal and state level are being considered. Should we have more toll roads? Should the federal government allow more tolling on interstates? Vehicle miles traveled as opposed to the gas tax. And then one of the other options could be more local control of roads, because North Carolina has more state roads than any other state except Texas, but we also have a higher portion of roads that are owned by the state than just about any place else. And so if we had more local control of the funding and the construction, then the local governments would be able to have a say.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has seen major changes in recent years in parental school choice. And one person who has watched those changes with interest is Neil McCluskey. He is director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you look at school choice and educational issues across the country. When you look at North Carolina, how do we stack up?
Well, I think North Carolina, relative to other states, so we're talking about a low bar here, but relative to other states, is actually doing a pretty good job on school choice, private school choice in particular. And so you have, I think it's three programs here, plus you just said your 529 savings accounts can be used for K through 12 education. They used to only be for higher education. So relative to other states, North Carolina seems to have embraced school choice and school choice programs. I've also looked at North Carolina just in terms of private school enrollment, and I actually had big increases in private school enrollment since 1991-92. A lot of that then also, that means without these programs. And so North Carolina is doing a good job of getting people access to private schools who want it. A lot more work to be done. And I think the state is doing that work, even as, you know, you always hit bumps in the road. But if you compare North Carolina to some states like New Jersey or New York, where private school choice programs are just anathema, they're not making any progress. North Carolina is doing a lot better than those states. There are a few states, though, they're probably even further along in embracing school choice than North Carolina. You think of Florida, probably first and foremost. You think of Arizona. Nevada had been making progress, but they took a step back. But, you know, probably Florida, Arizona are the two big ones. Wisconsin had been making a lot of progress, but they've taken a bit of a step back. But North Carolina is doing well, but still, so much more work to do because the norm, the default is still you go to a school you're assigned to based on your home address.
We're going to get into what North Carolina can do to help make even more access to school choice. But first of all, remind us from your perspective, why is choice important?
Oh, choice is important for many reasons. The one I think is most important, and my thinking on this has kind of changed over the last 15, 17 years that I've been working on this. I'm sort of embarrassed that it took me so long to reach this conclusion. The first reason we want school choice is we are supposed to be a society. The United States of America is supposed to be grounded in liberty, in freedom. And freedom means an education, people able to choose schools that they think are best for their kids. And that can mean pedagogically best for the kids, but it also means schools that share their values. And so that they don't have to fight with other people to impose their values on them because they all have to fund one government school in their district. Or they have to fight at the state level because the state now tells all public schools what to do. We want school choice because a free society demands school choice. It demands the freedom to choose different things, and public schooling doesn't allow that. And that's the first reason we want school choice. And we ought to go beyond calling it school choice. We ought to call it educational freedom, because increasingly you can choose educational options that don't happen in school. Online, you can get therapies and like with horses, all sorts of stuff that goes beyond schools. But then there are all the sort of traditional arguments, too, that a free market leads to competition. Enabling educators to decide how they want to educate lets them compete. It also drives innovation, and it's more efficient and it's more accountable if you have to respond directly to the people who want your service. So there are all those really crucial reasons for it, but reason number one is a free society should have an education system grounded in freedom.
You heard the words educational freedom. Neil McCluskey is director of the Center for Educational Freedom. It's located at the Cato Institute, the libertarian group. You mentioned also earlier Florida and Arizona as sort of the standout states. What could North Carolina do to get a little bit more like them?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that goes on in those states. Already you probably have people there who may be a little bit more inclined to freedom, to which would include school choice. But they've also, I think, made good pitches for school choice. And that includes talking about, you know, if we have school choice, we also need to reduce the regulations on traditional public schools, enable those traditional public schools to be competitive, because some of them don't want to just exist because you have to go there. They want to have the ability to do new and different things and compete with schools of choice. But they're often bogged down with rules and regulations. And certainly in Arizona, they've talked about, let's free everybody up to do different things. And in Florida, I think they've had similar discussions. But it's also important that they often elect people who tend to be friendly to school choice. And in Florida, they have had the benefit of Jeb Bush was their governor, very pro-school choice. And he continues to stay active in Florida, arguing for, campaigning for school choice. And there are a lot of groups that want it that are very active. And so I would recommend that people in North Carolina who want school choice, you've got to constantly be fighting for it and making the argument for it. And that argument, first and foremost, should be about free people should be able to choose the education they think is best for their kids.
That leads into the next question, which is that we have seen elected recently in the last cycle some people who've been more hostile to choice or at least skeptical. What are some of the best ways to make that case to them that, look, this is not D versus R, conservative versus liberal. This is something that everyone should be able to get on board with.
Right. Well, I mean, first we say it's freedom for everybody, and that's really important. This, I'm sure, gets touchy, and I'm not an expert in North Carolina politics, but I think of, for instance, the bathroom bill issue that really was kind of front and center in North Carolina. Instead of saying, well, we should require everybody either to have schools that don't allow a student to choose a bathroom or do, if you're either side of that debate, what you should want is a system where you can choose a school that shares your values. That may mean a school that says you choose the bathroom. It may mean you choose a school that says, no, we have traditional assignment to bathrooms. What we shouldn't be doing is saying, let's have a system where we're all forced into conflict. And that is what public schooling is when there are differences. You have to fight for who's going to get what they want out of the schools everyone has to pay for. The other kind of more mundane issue is people want school choice, and then they hear someone say, well, if there's school choice, it's going to take money out of your public schools. And we've got to explain to people better that even if money leaves your public school, one, it forces them to compete. And research has shown repeatedly that forces them to get better. But also that rarely does so much money leave a student that there isn't money left over, where there's actually more money per pupil in the school that they've left. And people love the idea of class size reduction and that having more money per pupil, which means more resources per pupil. And that point has to be emphasized over and over, because people are initially scared when they hear money will be leaving their schools. But if they hear more resources for their child if they stay there, that's something that people think is great. And we need to emphasize it.
In the brief time that we have left, is there one particular item in the school choice front that you see for North Carolina that this is something you ought to move toward?
We actually have some model legislation for a tax credit funded ESA so that the money never comes from the state. Because what we've seen is money that comes from a state, people tend to say, well, you got to regulate it because that's my tax money in part. A tax credit funded ESA, people would choose whether or not to donate to groups that set up these savings accounts. And they can choose to whom they send that, just like a regular scholarship tax credit, only now for an ESA.
One person who's going to continue to watch North Carolina as it deals with issues of school choice is Neil McCluskey, director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's longstanding vacancy on the federal district court could soon be filled by UNC law professor Richard Myers. The state's senior U.S. Senator Richard Burr recently touted Myers' record for Senate colleagues.
I believe his story is one we can all admire and appreciate. Professor Myers immigrated to the United States from Kingston, Jamaica at the age of 10 and moved with his family to Wilmington, North Carolina in the eastern part of our state, where his mother and brother still reside. He's first-generation college student, having received his undergraduate degree from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Following graduation, he worked as a reporter for the Wilmington Morning Star, covering local news and issues ranging from criminal cases to business development in Wilmington's thriving coffee and movie industries.
Myers eventually went back to school and earned his law degree. Then the September 11th terrorist attack prompted another career change.
While this act of evil was a turning point for our country, it was also a turning point for Professor Myers. Like so many others in the wake of the tragedy, he answered the call to service, dedicating his legal abilities to our nation's judicial system as a U.S. Attorney. Professor Myers said that choosing this new path, and I quote him, was something that I felt I could do and that I owed the country that had been really good to my family.
After completing his work as an assistant U.S. attorney, Myers returned to Chapel Hill to teach law,
instructing the next generation of lawyers to be people who, in his own words, and I quote, do the right thing every day. In this role, he's contributed not only to the education of his law students, but he supported their work for public interest organizations. For 15 years, he served as the auctioneer of the Carolina Public Interest Law Organization's auction, which raises money, enabling students to work in jobs such as the public defender or district attorney's office or a nonprofit organization. He's also done pro bono work consulting on his own for numerous nonprofits, has made it a priority to mentor students aspiring to serve in public service careers, and has given his time and his legal ability to ensure that our criminal justice system truly is just. Professor Myers is well-regarded, well-qualified, and I have faith in his ability to do the right thing every day.
One group actively opposed Myers' nomination, the students who will miss out on having him as a professor.
I would suggest to my colleagues this is a true statement of his qualifications for the job he's been nominated and asked to serve in, that the students that look up to professors are the ones that judge this decision as their loss.
That's U.S. Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina touting the record of UNC Law Professor Richard Myers. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law is back. What is it? Where did it go? During a recent celebration of its return, Institute President Jeanette Doran offered some answers to those questions.
We were founded in 2004 by then-retiring Supreme Court Justice, and our mission at the time was to draw attention to state constitutional principles, and we were trying to enforce state constitutional limitations on government via litigation. And I first joined the Institute back in 2005 and worked with it for many, many years. But about 5 years ago, our board decided to sort of let things go, let things quiet down, figure out what would be a better, more effective way to ensure freedom and fairness and economic liberty. So what we did is we sort of went to a dormant phase. And this summer, our board decided, through the generosity of the Pope Foundation and other generous donors, to restart. And this time what we're going to do is try to work collaboratively with not just the legislature, but also with public officials at the city, town, county level, and also with agencies.
Doran explained how the Institute for Constitutional Law will work moving forward.
In order to promote both freedom and economic prosperity, we're going to focus on three principal areas. One will be education law, making sure that we can preserve the progress that we've made in school choice, and making sure that government does not determine, as they have for decades, that they know more about our children than we do as parents, because ultimately the people who are most responsible for their children and have the greatest vested interest aren't bureaucrats, they're moms and dads. So we want to keep up. And then we're also going to look to emphasize regulatory reform and the separation of powers.
Why the separation of powers? Doran points to her own recent history in state government.
I've been on the Rules Review Commission for 8 years now, and that's the agency that's the final approval for virtually every rule or regulation in the state of North Carolina. We really need to make sure that if agencies and bureaucrats are promulgating rules and regulations, that they have the statutory authority to do it, that they are not usurping statutory authority, and further, that the legislature has a full and comprehensive understanding of the real minutiae of these rules. And unfortunately, we don't have anybody who's really been focusing on that, and certainly not from a separation of powers constitutional perspective.
Doran outlined the Institute's priorities. She says those priorities also require her to turn her attention to another important topic.
In order to make sure that all of these things proceed, we're also going to have to focus on election law and redistricting, which, as some of you may have seen in news reports and on social media, yesterday we took our very first official action by requesting the public records from both Representative Deb Butner and Representative Darren Jackson, because I'd really like to know what it is that the Democrat minority whip was talking about during her rant on the House floor when she said, "We are right now downstairs redrawing the maps." Ladies and gentlemen, that is not the way that process is supposed to go. The court was crystal clear about it, and we cannot let it slide. So we have submitted that public records request, and we are ready to pursue any and all options available to us to make sure that the court order is complied with. Now, it doesn't matter whether you like that court order or not. Frankly, it's cringeworthingly flawed. But the fact is, it is the court order, and it is the position of the General Assembly that they will comply with it in the interest of the people of North Carolina. The people deserve nothing less than full and complete compliance with an order of transparency. That is what the legislature has determined. The legislature represents the people, and that's what we need to move forward with.
People pay a reasonable amount of attention to the U.S. Constitution. Doran wants to focus on North Carolina's governing document.
Just to make sure that everyone here really fully and completely understands just how important the state constitution is, and it's never as sexy as the First Amendment or the Second Amendment or the Bill of Rights. Everybody's always talking about that. And those are obviously really important, but so is the state constitution.
Doran also wants to clear up any misconception about who's paying the bills for the newly revived institute.
Notwithstanding our name, North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law, we proudly receive no government funding. I wouldn't take it if they offered it.
As Jeanette Doran resumes work as president of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law, she's getting some high-profile help. Former State Supreme Court Justice Robert Edmonds explains why he looks forward to the Institute's new work.
The courts, the General Assembly, so many institutions here in Raleigh really need education about the state constitution. As Jeanette said, you know, most people have some notion of what the U.S. Constitution says, in places at least. But people are still learning about the state constitution. And I think what she's going to be doing, what picking up the work that she's discussing, is going to be just invaluable to all of us, not just in this room, but in Raleigh and across North Carolina.
Another former Supreme Court justice and appeals court judge, Robert Hunter, also sees the importance of the North Carolina Constitution.
I got fascinated with the state constitution when I was trying a case in the 1980s called Jingles versus Thornburg. And Jingles versus Thornburg, people don't realize the critical nature of that case. It completely transformed the entire country because it created opportunities for blacks and Republicans to get elected to office throughout the entire country, led to the Gingrich Revolution in 1994, and finally, after 100 years, 110 years, gave the Republicans a chance to win in the state legislature, gave us Republican judges and justices, and it was a groundbreaking thing. And I began learning what people are learning now about the Republican Constitution of 1868, which is still the Constitution we use today, by and large. And there were so many things in it that people don't read about that were very radical for their time, and they're still considered very radical. And so it's fascinating to me to watch all these little nuances of when you find someone like the light goes on in some lawyer's head somewhere, and he actually sits down and reads the Constitution. And then he says, well, wait a minute, that applies to my case.
Jeanette Doran explains why her group will be tackling important tasks.
As we go forward, we're going to be working, as I said before, trying to prevent constitutional violations instead of having to litigate them after the fact. All of that makes a huge difference. It can mean the difference between liberty and prosperity and disaster. Quite frankly.
You've been listening to highlights from the event Relaunching the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The numbers have made national headlines. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, from 2017 to 2018, the number of people in this country who do not have health insurance went up. So why is that? And who's responsible? Jordan Roberts has been looking at those questions. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Jordan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the numbers from the Census Bureau.
Right. So this was the 2018 insurance numbers that looked at the changes from 2017 to 2018 and looking at the changes in specific categories. And so this was the first time in about a decade that the number of total insured Americans went down. And so that was a cause for concern for a lot of people. The numbers went from 7.9% in 2017 to 8.5% of Americans without insurance, about 27 million Americans. So this was a slight uptick, but the critics of these numbers, I don't think really have the full story here.
Tell us about that, because they actually break these numbers down, Census Bureau, into those with private insurance and what happened there, and those with public insurance, Medicare, Medicaid.
That's right. So some of the biggest changes were that, you know, overall the number of insured went down, but private plans went down a little bit as well. And the big number, I think, to take away from this is that the number of people on Medicaid went down too. So, you know, in a growing, strong economy, that's a good thing that people are making too much money to qualify for low income assistance. So I think that's the big thing to take away. And also, the amount of people in the individual market, that what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to build up a strong individual market, that number has been declining significantly, especially those at the top of the income level who don't have subsidies. So those are the two biggest drops, which, you know, don't really tell the picture or don't really tell the story of the Trump administration sabotaging the Affordable Care Act.
I want to get to some of the things that the Trump administration is doing to try to provide everyone with more options, including some of those folks who are kind kind of at that point where they don't have employer insurance and yet they don't qualify for a subsidy. But first, on the issue of the uninsured, isn't it fair to say also, Jordan, that there may be people who simply say, look, you know, I've got enough money. If something happens to me, I'm going to roll the dice. I'm just going to pay for it. People who simply say, I don't want to, or I think I don't need it.
Right. You know, and remember the individual mandate, the provision in the Affordable Care Act that mandated that everyone have insurance was repealed as a part of the tax cuts bill that passed Congress during the Trump administration. But, you know, so for the first time in 2019, people won't have to have insurance. So that could be a number, or that could be contributing to the number of people that also aren't having insurance. But also, it's, I think it's a really important point that the largest drop of people without insurance was those above 300 or 400% of the federal poverty level. So these are people that are making enough money to afford insurance, but they can't afford the premiums that, you know, are available to them without any subsidies. So these are the people that are dropping, and that's an inherent flaw of the Affordable Care Act, that if these people don't get work or don't get insurance from work and their only option is the Affordable Care Act and the plans aren't affordable, then, you know, what good does that do? So that's what we saw, is those people at the higher end of the income level weren't getting subsidies and couldn't afford it, and they're dropping the most. And so, you know, the Trump administration, with their healthcare executive order to bolster association health plans, short-term limited duration insurance, and health reimbursement accounts, those were specifically aimed at that population that can't afford Affordable Care Act plans anymore.
Let's talk a little bit more about each of those. Let's start with the short-term plans. I got to tell you, it's happened to me during my career. I know people that this has happened to. For one reason or another, you find yourself without insurance and you need kind of a bridge to your next job or whatever. You need it for 6 months. You maybe need it for a year. Is that what that part of the Trump executive order is trying to address?
Yeah. And short-term plans have been around for a while, but the affordable or the Obama administration really limited their use to only 3 months. And so the Trump administration expanded that so you can have them for a lot longer now and renew them up to a couple of years. So it's exactly for that scenario you're talking about, where you're in between jobs, out of college, looking for a job, and you can pick up a short-term plan. It doesn't have to abide by all the Affordable Care Act rules, but that makes it much more affordable, and you still have a little peace of mind that you have some protection if anything were to happen.
That's an important point. You bring up the Obamacare mandates. Just give us a quick primer on that and why those premiums can be so expensive.
Right. So when the Affordable Care Act was implemented, they mandated that 10 essential health benefits must be covered in all plans that are sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And what we know about health insurance mandates is that when you require an insurer to provide a benefit, then that has to be spread across the entire risk pool, and that increases costs for everyone. So, you know, someone in the same risk pool as me may need maternity coverage, but I don't. And so, you know, mandating that across the board raises costs for everyone. So that was a big driver of costs of premiums, were all those benefit mandates that the Affordable Care Act required.
Association health plans, you've been writing a lot about those as well. I'm starting to read more and more, hear people talk about those, and that's part of the Trump administration executive order to try to offer more choices to people. How do they work?
Well, so association health plans allow groups of individuals or small businesses to band together and buy large group health insurance through a trade association or business association. Previously, individuals and small businesses would, their only option were to buy health insurance on the individual market. And as we've been talking about here, a lot of times those plans are unaffordable, so they would either go without insurance or, you know, be struggling to pay those bills. And when you can, as individuals or small groups, when you can get together as a large group, you can really, you know, reduce that price of insurance, make it much more affordable, and provide people who may not have had insurance before with insurance. So it's a good, we think it's a good policy.
So that's coming from the Trump administration. Now, does the state of North Carolina have to do anything in its statutes in order to make sure that those AHPs actually are active and an option for people?
Yeah, and luckily, North Carolina did pass a bill to open up and allow association health plans to be sold. Unfortunately, they can't be sold right now. There's some federal litigation trying to figure out, you know, exactly what the final rule means, and there's been some challenges to it. So hopefully, we'll get get that figured out. The Trump administration's appealing that ruling right now. So hopefully soon in North Carolina, people will be able to buy insurance through an association health plan.
Amazing, or maybe not so amazing, that there would be a legal challenge to offering people more options. And
unfortunately,
the classic example you've written about in terms of these AHPs is like realtors.
Right.
They're kind of independent workers. And who would they band together with in order to have that group power? You know, that's what that's all about.
Absolutely. So they can get together with other realtors. They're in the same line of business. They have similar interests. And so the North Carolina Realtors Association could design benefit plans that, you know, a whole host of plans that, you know, meet the needs of their members. And so there's a real incentive there to, you know, provide good coverage for your trade members.
Jordan, do you feel like we are making progress towards opening up things and giving people more choices and trying to increase the access to an affordable health insurance policy?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the executive order from the Trump administration did do this. But, you know, I think repealing the Affordable Care Act and giving the states full power would unleash a host of choices. But in the absence of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, the Trump administration has done this through executive order to try to just increase any choices. And that's what they did through this executive order.
That's what Jordan Roberts writes about. You can find all of his work at johnlock.org. Also, carolinajournal.com. Jordan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.